The Burrows of Berea is a conversational podcast.
We study the Bible and we talk about it.
Not all of us are of the same faith.
And one of us doesn't have a faith.
But we still love one another, and we're going to continue to talk about these things.
The things we believe in and the things we believe about what we read in the Bible. Not all of these are necessarily true. Some of it is opinion and speculation. Thank you for
listening and speculating with us.
There you go. That was good. Yes.
You are listening to the Burrows of Berea.
Well, welcome back to the Burrows of Berea. I'm Rick Welch, and to my right is Rick Big Daddy Carter.
Oh, yeah.
Behind the glass is Rocket Man Andy Bishop.
Pacow.
How you guys been?
Oh, good. I'm just busy week. Yeah. One of those weeks where you're like, oh, I have 3 free hours today, and then you blink and somebody's like, where's that mix? And
yeah.
It'll happen in this particular time that I thought was free. It's like one of those weeks.
For me, it's been like the rain. My goodness. We got 11 and a half inches at our house in 1 week.
Wow. Well, do you think that's the same here? You're not
I don't
far.
Know. No, I'm just in Hooper's Creek. I'm not far, but where we are, we just got hammered with a bunch of rain.
No, we got it every day too, but it kind of worked out. It never stopped anything. You know, if it rains hard enough here, it kind of sucks if you're trying to do acoustic guitar.
Yeah,
but it just never lined up that way. It's amazing how infrequently it does.
Yeah, that's good. But so we're here on a Saturday, and it's just
Super Saturday.
Super Saturday. Super it's just Saturdays. Us three. And the reason why is because our friend Daniel Rogers from Alabama has come to visit with us in studio.
Hello.
Special
guest. So glad you're here.
Good to be here.
I got to meet you at the Blue Point Bible Church conference, and that was the first time I'd ever met you. I'd seen you online on YouTube and speaking with Don Preston, and because we'd had Don here. And Don's coming back in October.
Ooh,
yeah, great. He is. He's going to be doing a debate with a scholar named Richard Carrier. He's an atheist scholar, and it's going to be going through Derek Lambert's channel, MythVision. So we're going to be recording here simultaneously as MythVision is recording, and they're going to be debating.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so it's going to be pretty fun. It's an online debate, but we're going to be physically here, and they're going to be physically there.
Oh, that's totally cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. So it's something that is pretty cool. But anyway, that's how I got introduced to you, actually, before you ever knew who I was. That's how I saw you. But you're here today. You're going to share your personal testimony, and then you're going to stay afterwards, and we're going to do a series on the eschatology of 1 John.
Sounds good to me.
I'm super excited. So have you ever listened to one of our testimony episodes before?
I'm not sure if I've listened to one of your testimony episodes.
Okay.
After I met you last fall, I went through and listened to just some select things, but I don't know if I specifically listened to a testimony episode.
Yeah.
What are the Burrows highlights for a person that doesn't know?
Yeah, what are they?
Mm-hmm. When I tuned in, y'all were talking about LGBTQ inclusion and whether or not it was biblical, and somebody was doing a side.
Teasy's thing. Yeah.
Same sex in the Bible.
A lot of episodes.
It was. That was a really strange thing for me to go through, because I have the fundamental side that I deal with on a regular basis. And then for her side, she's more on the liberal side. And so when we come, and I love Teasy, like with my whole heart, I love that one. She's amazing. But she brings a lot of research into it. And, you know, by the time we got to the end of it, she was like, within the Christian world, she was the one standing alone again, you know, at that, and she was very disheartened by it. But then at the same time, she also felt a little bit more compassionate on our end, and we felt more compassionate towards her at the end. And it was a strange time, but it was cool, and I learned a lot.
Yeah,
about
she
Greek culture.
Good, she put a lot of research.
A lot of research. Yeah,
she does.
And so she took notes from the underground, actually, which was a part of the Burrows, and now she's kind of doing her own thing. And then we just kind of like sometimes we get together and mix it, and it's a lot of fun.
Cool,
I enjoy it. But yeah, so you got to hear that.
For me, it's still like the Gospel of Adam and Eve.
Yeah,
like, we got to do a must do list.
Like, that was the. What was that called? The life of Adam and Eve. Yeah, the pseudepigraphal work.
Yep.
So anyway, what I ask every guest, the first question I always ask is, to the best of your ability, can you tell me what the earliest memory that you have of when you heard the name Jesus Christ?
Well, it would have had to have been singing in VBS, Jesus Loves Me. Mm. You know, that would have had to have been it. Now, if you want to get technical, Jesus Christ, I probably couldn't remember that particular, you know, phraseology, but the name Jesus, definitely singing Jesus Loves Me in the 3-year-old Bible class or VBS at church, for sure.
So you grew up in a Christian home, I assume?
I did, 100%.
Okay. 100%, yeah. So that's a lot of people that we have on here have that similar story that they started out, which is really cool to me that a lot of our guests do that, that have that story, you know, that they were raised in a Christian home. And then we have some guests, of course, that weren't. But knowing you and knowing where you've landed eschatologically, for example, I know that there's been a lot of changes even since becoming a Christian. So I wanted to hear like your story. So tell me, like, so you were raised in a Christian home. Kind of walk us through it from then and until now.
Yeah, so I was raised in the A Cappella Churches of Christ, if you're familiar with that.
I'm not.
Okay.
So is there singing involved?
Yes, yes.
There is. There has it sounds to be. Like there's no yeah, instrumentation. Definitely.
Four-part harmony, actually.
Oh, that's awesome. So, I'm kind of in.
Yeah, well, from a very young age, they kind of recognize, okay, is he going to be a bass? Is he going to be a tenor? Ha. And then you start sitting next to people that sing that, you know, that particular part, so you can pick up on it, learn how to read sheet music and everything. Yeah.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
So is it, and I assume there's never any instrumentation?
Never.
Okay.
In fact, they would go so far as to say that it is a sin to use instruments in worship.
What?
Getting less cool, but the first part still holds.
Yeah. Well, so in basically, this was before I was born. In the 1800s, the two guys, Alexander Campbell and Thomas Campbell, the father is Thomas Campbell, son is Alexander Campbell, they travel over to America. They had been trained in the UK in theology, super smart. They came from a Presbyterian background, and they had become disheartened with the division within Christianity, all these different denominations, one on every corner, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so they thought that the only way to usher in the millennium, they were a post-millennial view, was to bring about Christian unity through getting back to the Bible, was the idea. Beyond creeds, beyond statements of faith, everything, beyond different allegiances to Calvin or Luther or whoever, and get back to just pure biblical Christianity, which always sounds good in the first generation. But in the second generation, you have your unspoken creeds and ideas, and what do we need to do? What do we not need to do? What's our pattern of New Testament Christianity? And what started as an ecumenical unity movement devolved into basically, well, there's a lot of divisions, but basically three major branches: the Disciples of Christ,
I'm sure you've heard of them,
the Christian Church, and then the Churches of Christ.
Okay.
On the census, those are the three major divisions. Disciples of Christ being a little more liberal, the Christian Church being more of your typical kind of evangelical sort of field, music and things like that. But Churches of Christ are the more far conservative, far right, fundamentalist, you know, take on Christianity. Mm-hmm. So no instruments, no women in leadership, things like that. You had to take communion every Sunday to follow the biblical pattern of worship. Very exclusive kind of take on Christianity. People would ask me all the time, and I still get asked this question when they figure out my background. They say, oh, so you're the ones who think that you're the only ones going to heaven, which was true. We did. We really did. And we would say, well, actually, God is the judge. But what we meant was, yes, God is the judge, and he's judged us perfect in every way, and he's judged you a heathen. So this is the world in which I grew up. And when I was about 3 years old, my biological father told me this story. My mom had me before she was married, and so my biological father is not a member of the Church of Christ, but he wasn't as involved in my raising, but I would still see him about once a week, right? Mm-hmm. And when I was about 3 years old, we were leaving my grandmother's house on Sunday afternoon after he picked me back up. He had to get me back home by 5 so I didn't forsake the assembly of the PM service.
Ah, okay, yes. Yeah.
And as we were going down the road, I pointed to a church. It was a Baptist church. And I said, ooh, that's the bad church. And he said, what do you mean the bad church? But that's how I was raised. I think that we were the only ones going to heaven. You had to worship exactly like us, believe about baptism exactly like us, take communion as often as we did, sing without instruments, believe what we did about all these different things, premillennialism, you know, you're going to hell if you're a premillennialist, all this kind of stuff. So very, very exclusive. Mm-hmm. And growing up, my granddad was the minister at the church that I was raised in. And
this would have been your mother's father?
My mother's, yeah, that's right, my mother's father.
Was he a bass?
I think he sung a mixture of bass and tenor. So if the song was really low, he could do the bass.
He could get it. Fancy. Yeah, I was right. I had vibes. I was like, Grandpa might be a bass.
Yeah. But he actually didn't. What's funny is he doesn't like go into singings. You know, that's one thing we do in the Churches of Christ is we have these gospel singings on, you know, Friday nights. Mm-hmm. And they're all over Alabama. And you can go, there's two or three of them going on every weekend. So you can take your pick. And he didn't really like to go to those. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. But everybody else did. So we...
Heck, I think I'd go to one at least once.
Yeah, so your grandfather is the minister of that of the church you grew up in.
That's right. He was. He was bivocational. He figured out that having your religious beliefs attached to a paycheck wasn't always the best idea. Mm-hmm. And so he quickly took on a job as a postman. And so he retired from the United States Postal Service just 5 or 6 years ago, really.
Okay.
An early blue-collar pastor.
Yeah.
As they call him.
Yeah, and so he was the minister until I was probably 6 or 7. And then he stepped down and wanted somebody else to take his place because he just got kind of tired of the church politics and things like that. There was a split over personality differences while he was there, and it just was kind of ugly. Mm-hmm. And so he just taught a Bible class and just sort of – he didn't mind his own business, but that's basically what he was trying to do is mind his own business, right? And eventually he became an elder of the church there. The Church of Christ, our structure is every congregation is autonomous. So there's no central denominational headquarters that you have to answer to. There's no ordination process that's denominational wide or anything like that. It's on a congregation by congregation basis. And he became an elder. And my stepdad, who married my mom when I was 3, he was the other elder. And there was a series of ministers that came through during that time, and actually only about 3 or 4 different ministers. We didn't have all too many different ministers. One was minister there for a long, long time. And in high school, we started doing this thing on the 5th Sundays where the young men would take over the service. And we, you know, one of us would preach and the other would say the prayer and another would lead singing and everything. And hey, we have a pitch pipe that you have to blow to get the key.
Oh, okay.
It's not an instrument. It's a musical aid.
Oh.
Oh.
Because you're not going to play a pitch pipe for music.
Well, it's only when you don't play it at the same time as the music, I think. Yeah, if you play it at the same time as the singing, it quickly becomes an instrument. Yeah,
I tried to play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star on it. You got to like spin it really fast. You know?
That would be a challenge. Yeah. Absolutely.
Cool. Absolutely, yeah.
Sinning in the church. But that's interesting way to sin.
I just wanted everybody to know that is not an instrument. That's just a
tool. It's a musical aid.
Just a tool.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Just a tool. I feel important. The hints of sarcasm. Yeah, I feel it.
It's not a circular harmonica.
Yeah.
And so I fell in love with preaching. Mm-hmm. But because of the situation my granddad had gone through or in his ministry, and there's a whole back story to all that, he didn't want me to go to our version of seminary. Now, we didn't have seminaries because we weren't a denomination like all these other denominational people have seminaries. We just had preaching schools. That's what mm-hmm. we called them. We did the same thing with revivals. We didn't have revivals. We had gospel meetings because we didn't need reviving. We were the one true church, right?
Right, so, okay.
Yeah. No resurrection there.
It's important to have your definitions correct. That's good.
Yeah, we've been erect this whole time.
Yeah, so we had our own nomenclature, you know, and it was definitely insider language. And you could very quickly pick out who was in on the insider language and who was out, you know. Mm-hmm. It's very easy to see. And so I ended up going to Auburn University for biosystems engineering instead of going into a seminary kind of setting. Like
that
really
is impressive.
Kind of, yeah. I spent too much time drinking and studying the Bible to
at least. Yeah. Let me put it this way: it sounds real cool. I don't know what it is, but it sounds very smart.
Well, you could have said it was just a wedding setting the whole time.
Biosystems engineering actually is a study of how to optimize agriculture, and so they work a lot with. For example, I used to go take soil samples in the field for my uncle, and we would send that off to the lab at Auburn or at Mississippi State. They would send us back exactly what kind of chemicals the soil needed to be most efficient. You plug that information into your tractor, and your tractor is so precise that it can spray the exact amount that each part of the field needs and know because of the map, like where to change.
The new that's kind of cool because I watch a channel that's all they do is show you about how they farm now.
Yeah.
And they've got the only brand that I know that all the brands are doing this, but John Deere has an ExactEmerge planner that will spray shot the fertilizer at the time when the seed goes in so that you're not just broadcasting it the whole time. So you basically go from like 100% of fertilizer now, what you used to where now you're doing probably 20% of fertilizer in the field.
Yeah.
So it, yeah.
So it sounds like the work that you were doing is part of that.
Oh, man, it's crazy how
in the university system, they're
scientific. They've gotten to farming now.
Well, I think that's better. I mean, you're using 20% fertilizer compared to 100%. Yeah,
that's
got to be better.
That's a big cost savings.
Safe cost. They're big on the environment, taking care of the environment, and you know, very conscious of runoff and things like that when they're, you know, working in the fields.
The only thing is they're getting more autonomous now.
Yeah,
they are. Yeah, if you go.
That someday the tractors will rise up and make the tomatoes bad.
that's only when AI gets involved with tractors.
So that the movie of the bad tomatoes will become nothing but a prophetic
attack
movie.
Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
Oh yeah,
it'll become a prophetic movie.
That's how it goes down.
That's how it happens. Yeah, if you go to Moultrie, Georgia, they have the Sunbelt Ag Expo. It's a huge thing. You can actually watch. The tractors, they're out there in the fields like Roombas, you know, just ping-ponging around.
Yes.
Wow.
That's doing their own thing. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, the newest John Deere now can basically go full autonomous.
Wow.
Yeah, my pawpaw thought it was bad when they put air conditioning. Yeah, that was sissifying tractors. And now,
yes, of course.
Now they drive themselves.
But was he okay with the awning on it?
I don't know. Well, he had one with an awning on it with no air conditioning. I would sit on a 5-gallon bucket, and every time we would hit a bump, my back would slam into this bolt. It was great.
I used to sit on the fender.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I'd sit on the fender the entire time.
I did that on the one that didn't have a top that we used for gardening.
Yeah.
But the big Massey Ferguson, I sat on the 5-gallon bucket.
Well, when they finally got the top put on, the baseport of the awning was so big, it basically took up the fender. So now I had to stand next to him on the ledge, on the footrest, and stand there the whole time.
Yeah.
And get my head beat against the support.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. When I was at Auburn, I exaggerated a little bit. I studied the Bible a lot. I was really into studying about the debates on the Holy Spirit and, you know, cessationism versus the continuous operation of the Spirit today, etc. And I was also set on converting everybody at Auburn to the Church of Christ. And so I would walk down the concourse in between classes, and they have all these organizations set up to try to get you to join their club, you know, whether it's the video game club or the robotics club.
Oh, I could join that one.
Yeah, yeah. And they have all these religious clubs too. And I would just go between them and aggravate them until, you know, until they would either admit defeat or just tell me to go on.
You'd fit right in with us.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I got a hold of this Catholic guy one time. And he was the president of the Catholic club at Auburn University. And we would get together and debate for hours at a time. We became really good friends. And at one point, he said, "Daniel, you know, you wouldn't even have the Bible if it wasn't for the Catholic Church." And I looked at him and said, "Well, that wouldn't be the first time that God spoke through a jackass."
Hey, there's a burrow joke.
Yeah, there
we go. You had that one locked. You had to have.
Yeah.
Of course, the other thing I was doing there was I was raised in a family with 9 other kids. I had 3 biological brothers and sisters.
Oh,
and,
man, you were.
And 6 adopted brothers and sisters. And I was the sports complex chauffeur. So I'd help drive them to basketball practices and t-ball practices and everything else. And when I went to college, all I did was study the Bible / play a little bit of Call of Duty. Modern Warfare 3 came out that year.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The other side was I just played a bunch of beer pong. So
nice.
That was great.
Yeah.
Anyways, I was totally dissatisfied with that arrangement. And 2 years into
The beer pong in Modern Warfare wasn't enough.
Yeah.
Well, not doing well in classes as well as I could have done, I guess. And, you know, not being able to do what I really wanted to do, which was work in ministry. That's really what I wanted to do. And so
And every good minister starts off with Call of Duty and beer pong.
Yeah. That's right. You can't preach, you know, thou shalt not kill until you've gotten
right.
A lot of it out of your system.
until you've dropped a lot of AC-130s, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
So,
yeah, or cussed out a lot of young kids.
Yes,
that's true. Or been called a lot of awful racist epitaphs, no matter what you look like.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Well, the best time in those games is at Christmas, you know, because you've already played the game for like 3 or 4 months, and all these little kids are getting the game for Christmas, and then you can just smoke them.
Yes. Yes.
That's so funny.
They're like, oh, Mom, I got the game. Oh, this guy just dropped 40 kills on me. You know?
So, yes.
Oh, that's great.
So then they changed it to a class-based system where you can't always just kill the noobs.
Yeah, you can't pub stomp anymore.
Yeah, you can't do that anymore.
Skill-based matchmaking.
Yep.
It's a shame.
Yeah.
It's a shame. I'm just waiting until my son gets old enough to really get into Super Smash Brothers.
Yeah. So you can dominate him all the time.
Before he's able to beat me every time, you know?
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Supply Chain Solutions.
Supply Chain Solutions is a third-party logistics company providing small to mid-sized businesses an outsourcing option focusing on warehouse management, customization of products, assembly, and packaging of goods, and has the ability to meet business-to-business and business-to-consumer fulfillment needs. Supply Chain Solutions continually strive to be their customers' most highly valued partners for quality, delivery, responsiveness, and customer service. To learn more about Supply Chain Solutions, you can visit their website at www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com. That's www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com.
And now back to the show.
Yeah, so I reconnected with a friend I had in high school at that time, Laura, and I messaged her on Facebook and basically was just trying to hit her up, you know. Mm-hmm. And we ended up talking and dating, and I told her what I wanted to do. And so she called around to all these churches in her area and said, hey, do you know anybody that's looking for a minister? You know, and they found this, she found this church about 30 minutes from where she lived who had about 40 members or so and a really small country church. She calls me and she says, hey, you're going to get a call from Robert in just a few minutes. I said, okay. Yeah, he's calling you about a church. Oh, great. So he calls me up and gives me an interview over the phone. He says you ought to come and try out for us in a couple weeks. And so 2 Sundays in a row, I preached for the congregation. And before I knew it, I was packing up my car and I was moving up to Birmingham, Alabama. And I stayed up there for 2 years working at this church. I made a lot of money. I made $600 a month at this church.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Yeah, pulling it down, son.
Exactly. So
I hope this was like 1977. are you older than you look?
That was 2013. It was a really small church. They didn't really have the funds to pay anybody, which is why they were willing to take on somebody with no experience, you know, like myself.
And he was sleeping on the altar.
And so I went to community college and finished out an associate's degree while I was there. I went to school, you know, from 8:30 to about 3 in the afternoon. I worked at Walmart as a cashier from 4:30 to 12:30 a.m. every day except for Sundays and Wednesdays. And then, preached two sermons on a Sunday and taught a Bible class on a Wednesday for about 2 years.
That's busy.
Oh, yeah, very busy.
That's busy.
I didn't have any time to study for myself. I was a parrot. I was a professional parrot. I said everything. I didn't think that I was doing this, of course, but I said everything that they wanted me to say.
Yeah.
You know, I just repeated the old doctrines that I had learned and mastered from a very young age. You know,
sure.
We had a very intense way of approaching scripture that I was taught from a young age, how to do word studies, how to study a book, how to outline a book, all these things. And so I used all those skills very effectively in those 2 years. And then I got a message from a friend of mine who was my youth pastor, basically. We don't use the word pastor, by the way, but that's okay. a youth pastor.
Seems like very much a word salad.
It is, yeah. And he said, hey, I'm stepping down from the church here at Piedmont where you were raised in Alabama. This, you know, where my dad and granddad were the elders, the two elders. And it was a full-time position. And you don't just work with the kids, but you do kind of everything. You work with, he had moved into kind of a senior pastoral at that point. And so I reached out to my dad and granddad and I said, hey, I want to come and try out, you know, treat me like everybody else, give me a fair shot. So I went, tried out for this church. They met with the congregation. They talked amongst themselves. They decided to hire me on.
Mm.
So I'm the minister. My dad and my granddad are the elders, no nepotism at all. And I went from that schedule I just mentioned to you to taking a semester off of community college and being able to work full-time as a minister without having to be bivocational.
Wow.
Which means I had all that time to study scripture nonstop.
Mm-hmm.
And that was January of 2015. In February of 2015, I reached the conclusion that the last days were past.
Yeah, wow, a month.
Yeah. I wasn't a full preterist by no means, but I took that information to a friend of mine, and I said, hey, he said, what do you think about eschatology? I said, I don't know. I just think the last days are past. It seems like that was the last days of the Jewish state or whatever. And he said, oh, you're a preterist. I go, I'm a whaterist? You know, what are you talking about? Well, he happened to be writing a college essay on the history of eschatology within the churches of Christ.
Okay.
And so he broke it down for me about how we started out post-millennial and pre-millennial, and then we moved to more of an amillennial position in the 1920s to 40s. And then in the 1970s, there was this guy named Max King, and he did this whole preterist thing. And I said, well, that's absolutely crazy. There's no way that any of that's true about the, you know, Jesus already coming back and the resurrection being passed. I'm going to disprove it. And so I didn't buy any books or anything, or didn't even know where to start.
No, that's a good thing, I think.
I just sat down with my Bible and looked up every passage related to eschatology that I could think of, 2 Thessalonians 1 and 2 Peter 3. And by the end of the summer, towards the end of the summer, I felt like everything except for maybe 1 Corinthians 15 and 2 Peter 3, well, it was in the past, was related to the fall of Jerusalem. I didn't know how to make those two fit necessarily. Until one day I said, you know, let me look at the word elements. And I looked up that word, element stoikion, I think, and discovered it was related perhaps to the law, like in, as it's used in Hebrews and Galatians and Colossians. And
yeah, like more like elementary principles.
Yeah, elementary principles. And so I thought, oh, wow, well, I don't know how this fits, but that seems to make a lot of sense, you know. That seems to put it within a first century context, especially because of the reference to the last days earlier in that chapter. And then I began to see the correlation between 2 Peter and Jude, and how basically 2 Peter is saying, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. And all the verbs are future tense, you know. But Jude, all the verbs are either past or present. Hey, they're here. The false teachers that the apostles warned about that would be scoffers in the last days, well, they're here. You know, the judgment, here it comes, everything. So that one fell into place. And then 1 Corinthians 15 fell into place for me when I was reading it and really trying to figure out what was going on. And at the very end there, he says, well, then it'll come to pass the saying, death is swallowed up in victory. And I thought, what saying is this? I haven't really thought about that before. And so I saw it was a reference to Isaiah chapter 27. Isaiah 27. And so I go back to that, and I go back to Hosea 13, and I go, wait a minute, this is all in the context of the covenantal judgment of Israel and whatnot. And so, you know, I don't really understand what's going on here, but the timing seems to line up with these other passages that I've studied. And at that point, I got on the floor in my office and started crying because I realized how others had been treated, you know, for having this view. And in sharing some of the things that I was learning with my family, I'd already seen how they were going to react at this point. Thing was, though, is I was taught that the most important thing that you can do is stand by truth. I was even told specifically this, if you study your scriptures and you reach a different conclusion than what we've taught you, you have an obligation to stand by it, because that's more important than anything
else. I was going to say, this is not the right truth.
Yeah.
All right. It's the wrong truth. Yeah. I'm sorry.
And guys would stand up every Sunday, you know, giving the communion talk or during the sermon, and they would say, if you just show us where we're wrong, we'll change. I mean, and I think they really believed it. The problem is, though, the first person who stands up and disagrees, you know, they get fragged before they can get out of the building, right?
Yeah, they become Stephen.
Yeah, yep. And so I went to my mom, who was my Bible study partner in many ways. You know, she had taught me the scripture.
Just so for Andy, when he said this becomes Stephen, Stephen was stoned by the
religious leaders.
Yeah, thank
you.
Actually, I was like, that reference flew right over.
Yeah, Stephen was killed by the Pharisees. He was stoned to death very early on for holding a different.
My whole brain was like, is that a modern warfare thing?
Yeah. It's
like, well, he did say frag, and I was like, dang, I missed a comment.
Yeah. Was this Stephen somebody that's terrible at modern warfare?
That's a good point.
He was one of the seven elders that were chosen by the apostles that were voted on him, and he was murdered basically for it.
Yep. He was kicked out of the clan.
Yeah.
Yes, kicked out of the clan. They cooked the grenade on him.
And that's not the Ku Klux Klan, so we all understand.
Yeah, the Call of Duty clan. He had to change his clan tag, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So to get you back where you were.
No, that's good.
Yeah.
You were, now you're on the ground crying. You know what's going to happen.
You're about to try to tell your truth, I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because you were taught that you have an obligation to do so.
Yes, absolutely.
Are you crying for yourself at any point?
Oh, well, absolutely. I don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. It was just overwhelming, you know, because up to that point, I still had a future coming to look forward to, you know, to hold on to. But whenever that last domino fell, there was nothing left at that point, right? So I didn't know what the implications of that were or anything. That's just what I saw.
It's the great abyss.
It's the burden of freedom, really.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's a good point.
Especially within your own groups where all your family are and everything else, that's going to change.
Yeah, and so I went to my mom and told her, and she couldn't believe it, really. You know, she said, "What do you mean?" You know, and then she kind of, she's like, I want there to be clouds. I want there to be that trumpet, you know, that kind of thing.
Of course.
And we had a very rocky relationship at the church for, that was September, October of 2015. So for a little less than a year, we didn't really have any major studies together that would, you know, go hours and hours on end, kind of like I did with the Catholic, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was just kind of something that we didn't really want to talk about, but needed to be discussed. And we kind of put it off. And finally in June of the next year, 2016. And there's a lot of mistakes that I could talk about that I did in the spring of 2016. I went to a conference, a preterist conference in Michigan.
Oh boy.
And spoke at that. And they got back to them that I'd done that. And that really wasn't all that good. But you know, when you are 20, let's see. So that was 2015. So I was 22 years old. You know, I felt like I needed community. I didn't have anybody to talk to, you know? And so I went up there on their invitation and spoke at that conference. And
speaking from experience, 22-year-olds can be a bit headstrong.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're very zealous in our behaviors.
Yeah. And so that June, the elders and my dad and granddad and the deacons at the church said that they'd sit down and study with me a few times and let me present my case. And before that was over, before we really got going good, and they told me I had a month in July. This is in July now of 2016. I had a month to change my mind, to resign from my posts, or they would have to fire me. I thought about it a lot. I thought, you know, I just need to stand up there and just let them have it, you know, tell them the truth, you know, or whatever. And about that time was whenever Don Preston debated David Hester from Faulkner University.
Yes.
So my parents did the most natural thing. They hired David Hester to come in and do a weekend seminar at the end of August.
Wow.
And so I, on
the, presumably these are the big guns here.
Yeah.
They are.
Yeah.
You know Don Preston. He came here. So this is the opposite. Okay. You know, these are these polar opposites. Yeah.
So I stood up the Sunday before he came and told everybody, you know, what I believed, and I didn't want it to cause division, so I was just going to step down and resign.
Wow. And that had to be hard at your age.
It was tough. I was 23 at that point.
Especially if you'd accomplished 24. What you dreamed for.
And it's your full-time job.
Yep. Full-time job. Freshly married. Only been married since the previous July, so a year at that point.
And it was a job that paid you enough to not do another job, which is a little difficult early in this particular career.
Now, right, exactly. And my wife was still in college to be
now,
a
y'all are
teacher.
Still married, correct?
Absolutely.
Awesome. Now, I'm curious to know, like, so that person, Laura, that called you.
Yeah.
Do you still have contact with her?
Oh, yeah. I sleep with her.
It's your wife. Bam.
Bam.
I didn't realize that, so I was going to connect you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
So that same person, Laura, earlier that got him his first job is now his wife.
Yes. We got married in July of 2015.
This is the other Churches of Christ where you can have like multiple.
Oh, no. Not the Church of Jesus Christ.
It's a polygamy church.
We just use his last name. No, we have two beautiful kids, Caden and Ellie Shea. Caden is 4 years old. Ellie Shea is going to be two in September. So just wonderful. And so we've Yeah.
Laura helped you get into the first ministry, where you're making $600 a month and still it's bivocational. Then yeah. this happens where you go to your family with your grandfather and your father. I'm assuming that this isn't as close because you were in Birmingham. So where is this church that you moved to? How far away from Birmingham was it?
Just an hour.
Okay. Yeah. So did she continue to go to church with you at that point?
She did. She did. She transferred to Jacksonville State University.
Oh, okay.
Which is just 12 miles away from Piedmont.
And oh, so, nice.
Yeah, she still went to church with
us. And so she stayed in church with you, and then you had already just been freshly married. This is your full-time position.
That's right.
You're coming to this. I imagine that you're talking to your wife about the things that you're studying.
Absolutely.
And she's coming on board with you along the time during that time?
She really didn't want me to talk to her about it. She wanted to study it herself.
That's awesome.
Wow.
And so she reached the same conclusions.
Wow.
Beautiful.
Way more easily than I did. I was way more stubborn. But
yeah.
Wow.
Yep. And so she reached the same conclusions.
I think that's the key to it, honestly, Daniel, is that people – they can either A, they can believe what somebody else tells them about it and then go on with that and then always have in the back of their mind wondering if it's accurate or not. And then you have the people that will actually put in the effort and the work and come to their own conclusion. Then they have a foundation they can truly stand on. So I commend your wife on doing that.
Oh, yeah. She's a way better person than I am.
Oh, wow.
Well, yeah. I also got to give you props for letting her do that on her own timing and not from the husband standpoint. Trying to push it in at all.
Forcing the issue. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I will speak at my failures at times where I get too involved.
Yeah. She would ask me questions from time to time, you know, and I would like try to answer the question with a question, you know, to just get her to start.
That's Christ-like, thinking, but, be honest. Every time he got asked something, he would always ask a question.
But she Socratic, I believe.
Yeah.
She came along with me and did.
Awesome.
Just so supportive in that whole time. I understood. You know, the trauma that I was experiencing in real time, you know, right there with me.
And we've had some dear friends that when they lost their faith or their church side of it, it grenaded everything.
Yeah, their families and everything.
Yeah.
Man.
I've spoken to a few people in the preterist community.
Yeah.
Have experienced something similar. And so.
So you stepped down.
I did. I stepped down. And they have a contract with all their ministers that, you know, you get 3 months severance pay, basically. And so I did get that. And
amazing.
During that third month, I got a letter in the mail. My mom's handwriting was on the address. Yeah. But it was a typed letter signed by my dad and granddad withdrawing fellowship from me, basically excommunicating.
Oh, that is talking about even in the family.
Yeesh.
Yep.
So this is, they're not going to be a part of your life anymore.
Yep. That's right.
Wait a minute. They're writing to you telling you they don't want you to be a part of the family anymore?
Not the church family in particular.
But that's also... Is that an underlining theme to that envoy?
Well, it's kind of hard to go to Christmas dinner with people that think you're going to hell.
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah.
Sorry,
I've done it. I've done it enough.
Yeah. And I was going to say, you can eat, you can get an extra plate of ham and nobody cares.
It's possible to get to that point. We're getting to that point now that we've had kids. But, you know, it wasn't definitely.
Yeah, wasn't like, then. Yeah.
Yeah, right, right. So then a month after that, I get a message from
another. That's kind of like getting a 40 bomb in a Call of Duty game, and then you lag out before the game finishes.
Yeah, almost the exact same feeling.
Yeah, just lags out.
With the years of therapy and meditation techniques and everything.
Yeah, it's like I'm killing them all. And then,
The only difference is, you know, nobody was called the N-word during this.
Right.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Just out of curiosity, I mean, I know you're going to say this, but did that just rip your heart out of your chest?
Not for a year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Start off a little angry.
Exactly. Yeah. I was definitely in attack mode at that point. You know, you have fight, flight, or fawn.
Yeah.
And I chose fight for sure.
Yeah.
And so I sent out letters to all the church members. You know, they've withdrawn from someone who is standing on the truth of the gospel and you know,
right,
whatever. Yeah. And nobody responded to those letters.
Of course not.
A month after that, I get a message from a friend, a picture of a letter he got in the mail at his church. Letters that were apparently sent out to every church on our mailing list that was in good standing, saying, hey, just to let you know, we've had to make the tough decision of disfellowshipping our preacher, who is also our son and grandson, Daniel Rogers. He has left the gospel. He no longer, you know, teaches truth.
Holy
He's a wolf mackerel. In sheep's clothing. If he comes to your church, you know, beware. We are marking him as a false teacher.
Wow.
Romans 16:17.
Wow.
Yeah. So that made it awkward to
go. So in their minds, they're giving you over to Satan.
Yes.
And they're hoping that you'll return.
I mean, they went scorched earth.
But they did.
Yes.
So they're turning you over to Satan. in their mind.
The problem was, I hadn't left Jesus, so I changed my mind on eschatology.
That's true for you, but in their mind, by shifting your eschatology, you've left the gospel.
Exactly. The thing, you know, thing about it was, if somebody knows that what they're doing is wrong,
right,
then there's a chance that that might work, you know, it might wake them up, you know. But for someone who truly believes that decisions that they've made and the conclusions that they've reached are consistent with Scripture or is what God wants them to do, you know, that method doesn't work.
That's right.
The interesting part is if you're the one that does that scorched earth and you don't get the response that you thought you would get out of it from the person, I wonder if it's got to leave some doubt in their mind.
It's difficult for me to imagine being in that head.
But you have to understand what indoctrination actually is from birth. Indoctrination is really you have an overwhelming sense of community first than you do to the truth. The idea of the truth being at the foundation of it is really second. It's not actually true. It's community that matters more than anything in indoctrination.
Yeah.
And so by the time, if somebody brings in a different truth, then the group collective work together.
You might fracture the church.
That's
the
idea, is
weaker.
That the community is now under fire. And so we have to like circle the wagons.
Now the community is more important than
let's use the word linchpin. That's the linchpin of indoctrination.
Yeah.
Is community.
Yeah. I've dealt with the same thing.
And you know what? Community might be more important than the
truth.
In
a lot of ways.
Sometimes. And literally, you know, historically, community is probably more important than what God you believe in.
Well, and the reality is, and maybe we'll get back to you, Daniel, because this is about you.
But yeah, totally.
It's the idea here is that once, and we've seen this in this, you know, in the studio, people talking about it, when they are shunned, one of the things that they long for the most is community. Daniel said it himself.
Absolutely.
He went to Michigan to teach because he wanted a fellowship, because you're alone. And that's a terrible feeling, is to be alone. And there's got to be a draw. I don't know if you ever felt this, Daniel, but in your heart, just as a person, just as a human being, knowing that, okay, now I'm out here on this island by myself, there's got to be the temptation, which it would have probably seemed like a temptation to you based on the way you were trained as a child, was to go back to that old community, but only... I guess fake it till you make it kind of an idea. I don't, maybe you didn't, but some people would do that. They would say, I'm going back because I miss my old friends. I miss my family. I miss my, you know, I don't want to be on this island.
Maybe so, you know, but
I don't know.
We were taught though, you know, from Matthew chapter 10, that the gospel divides father and daughter and son and mother, all these categories. And so when that happened, you know, in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, I have to make my stand. This is the truth. I have to stand by it. You know, I can't go back at this point. You know,
right.
This is what I've been called to do. Here's what's amazing about this whole thing is that October, so this is 2 months after I resigned, William Bell was having a eschatology conference in Memphis, which is only about 5 hours or so from where I live there. And so I drove up to it. And when I was there, I just felt this outpouring of love from all these different Christians. But here was the problem. These Christians were from Reformed, Presbyterian backgrounds, Pentecostal backgrounds, Methodist backgrounds, Church of Christ backgrounds too, non-denominational backgrounds. And what I had to, all these people, in other words, are going to hell, you have to understand.
Yes, of course.
And so—
Again, from your indoctrination.
Exactly. And so what I had to wrestle with at that point was, wait a minute, here's the fruit of the Spirit. Against such things, there are no law. And here's how I've been treated by the people that are in. Maybe God's grace is way bigger than I thought it was.
Yeah.
And so that began a several year long journey of trying to wrestle with this idea of who is actually a Christian, who is actually included in the family of God. And that took a long time.
Yeah, that's interesting and a pretty big question, even from the outside. Because you see, like, I mean, you look at how many splits there are, divisions and all this other stuff, and you're like, all right, how do we choose that in a way that's not just, no, it's the one I do. How do we choose where that's just not
How do you pick somebody outside of it? And that has got to be one of the most difficult things in the world when you've been indoctrinated, is to actually come to that conclusion. So I commend you on doing the hard work. It's hard to do.
I remember when I went to my first instrumental worship service.
Yeah. Was that uncomfortable?
I visited with a friend. I thought it would be.
Yeah.
And going into it, I thought, yeah, I know this is all going to be for show, like I've been taught, you know, it's going to be vain worship or whatever. But when I went in there, I saw, well, you know, as a musician, that when somebody plays an instrument, and you, I mean, you got Stevie Ray Vaughan playing a solo, or B.B. King playing a solo, or, you know, a jazz guitarist like John Scofield or somebody, you know there's more to it than just technical precision.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, they're putting themselves into it. And that's what I saw in the music. And I thought, you know, I've always heard this passage, Ephesians 5:19, Colossians 3:16, that we are to speak to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in our heart to the Lord. Mm-hmm. And people would very acutely say, well, yes, in our heart, not in our harp. That right. passage authorizes a cappella singing, not instruments. Huh. Although those pesky psalms talk about instruments all over the place.
All the time. Supposed to be singing, those pesky psalms.
Yeah. But anyways.
Darn David.
What I saw in that worship service was these people playing these instruments weren't playing from the instrument. They were playing from the heart. The instrument, in other words, became an extension of themselves.
Yeah.
And so it just totally changed my mind on how I viewed Christian worship. And that just started a whole snowball of transformation.
And that's so cool that this happened through music as well.
That's a fun byline.
It is to see, because I have, you know, I'm a musician as well. I mean, I'm not a great one, but I do know about expression in music.
Yeah.
And I've had many moments whenever maybe I was feeling melancholy and I get on the piano and I can express my heart in it, you know, and I get up and I feel better, even though I've just been playing this melancholy song, you know.
Music is a weird shortcut to, I want to say emotional manipulation, but it's because I lack the words that don't sound negative.
Yeah.
But it really, like, you can just pick a chord structure that somebody says, oh, this one's a bummer, and play it. It's a bummer every time, man.
Yeah.
You know, somebody can show you, hey, this is a happy chord progression. You can play it. It's happy. It's kind of happy feeling every time. It's just, but it's almost
also,
magic.
You're right. And there's also that thing, like, so if I sit down and I wrote that song that was very melancholy, the one thing that I do, and it is emotional manipulation. It's just, it sounds, let's make
yeah,
it a
it's
let's
like,
put a
I don't know a better
spin.
Word for it. Yeah.
Let's put a, it manipulates you into feeling a specific way.
In a way that you often want to feel, and that's why you choose that.
And
music.
When I play music, I love to play in the minors. And so, because I am, I feel all of those melancholy feelings. But the beauty of it is sometimes it'll take me back to when I wrote it or whenever I was feeling that way.
Sure.
And I'll see how far I've come since I wrote it then. And shows the growth, yeah. But yet I can still get back to that original feeling.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a story in the Bible about that, right? Where Saul is having these fits of rage, mm-hmm. and he would bring in David to play the harp to drive away that evil within him. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that why David was so vocal about music in the Psalms is because he literally used music as basically like a music therapy. Have you ever seen people that do music therapy?
Yeah.
Yeah. He was the first one of those.
He was. I mean, he first recorded at least.
It. Yeah.
You know, showing that, and he did. Of course, it didn't work ultimately with Saul. It helped him in his nightmares, but not necessarily in his daily choosings.
You can redecorate a room with a song.
Yeah, you certainly could. Yeah. So that's fascinating to me that you now you're seeing the other side of me. So this indoctrinated thought, your eschatological change, now your musical change.
I'm going to interrupt. This is dumb, but I'm going to. Somebody once said, art is how you decorate space. Music is how you decorate time, which I love that. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of cool, actually. Yeah. I love listening to 70s, like, soft rock. It puts me in a mood,
but
it's always 70s. You know, like as soon as you go there, it's like,
it's the 70s.
This is the 70s,
yeah.
baby.
So that's
sorry, I apologize.
It's so funny that you bring that up because my granddad had a radio station, same granddad, and he played soft rock.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
What was it? Casey Kasem's top?
Oh, yeah, the top 40.
Oh,
yeah.
He carried the Kasem feed or whatever. Yeah.
He did, yeah.
That's really cool.
So that's what we grew up listening to in the background.
Yeah. Yeah. Nothing like the Little River Band, man.
So you could have music, you just couldn't
not use in worship
for worship.
Yeah, we can listen to AC/DC, just not the Gaithers.
Okay,
okay. Good point.
You can go on a highway to hell, but trying to okay.
Yeah, that's good point. Funny.
All right.
Yeah, the only time we actually listened to gospel music was if a bluegrass band happened to sing a gospel song.
Ah.
Yeah. Otherwise, I mean, in the car we listened to the Eagles and. You know, Reba and everybody else like that. But
that's a good way to grow up, though.
We never listened to gospel music. When I went to this new church that I'm at now, they have a lot of contemporary Christian music. I don't know any of it. I had to go and learn because I just totally in the dark about that.
Yeah. Sure. And sadly, I'll just report that yesterday, a Southern gospel group called the Neelands perished in a plane crash yesterday, except for the one daughter. She survived because she drove. But this was in Seattle. They were going on a gospel cruise, to sing, a singing cruise, you know. So that just happened yesterday, the Neelands. So be praying for that family. That's awful.
Yeah, that's so sad.
It is. So I brought you that way down on that one. Sorry, but
redecorated the room there, right?
Yeah. So let's go with it. Let's go from here. So now you've seen this. You've visited a church. You've had music. You're starting to change. Your eschatological position has changed. You went to this William Bell conference. You've discovered this love and asked yourself about grace. So take us from there to now.
Yeah. So there's so much. I guess the popular word is deconstruction.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's so much of that that has to go on when you're raised in this sort of strict fundamentalist culture. We were raised young earth creationism. There was an intermingling of Christian nationalism and some of the apologetic stuff that we did. We couldn't use Ken Ham because he was going to hell. So we kind of just.
I'm sorry. It's just
we have copied what he did.
And I don't hear that in the
thing.
In conversations very often.
Right,
like a sentence I never thought I'd hear. Yeah. We can't do Ken Ham because he's going to hell. Oh,
so I went back and did a lot of. Well, he might get baptism wrong, you know.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Or music wrong.
He might be. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, you can't have that. So I went back and studied
these hints of sarcasm. They're so subtle but great.
They're awesome.
So I went back and studied a lot of that. You know, from how do we view the creation stories in Genesis 1 through 3? How do we view the metaphorical language in the Psalms? And, you know, obviously that goes into the apocalyptic language and prophecy in the New Testament. And, you know, who is in Christ? What is the role of baptism? You know, and then I delved into, you know, what about the afterlife? And so I studied all these different areas to try to go back and just see, okay, what was I given bears good fruit? And what was I given that needs to be probably discarded and rethought and rearranged? And so that's a journey that I'm still on. I still come across passages where I go, ooh, wow, I didn't even realize I still had that idea in the back of my head. You know, I need to rethink that. But it's been wonderful. I've been introduced to a wide range of authors from across the spectrum, people like Dallas Willard to, you know, Brian McLaren to Timothy Keller to John MacArthur. You know, I've gotten something from all those different guys, something that I didn't have a privilege of doing in my tradition because we could only read people within our tradition. Otherwise, you know, bad ideas might get in there somehow. So,
yeah, sure. Yeah.
The only time I ever read opposing views was in debate books.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. So are you... So what do you do now, today?
Yeah, so I went in 2018. I found a preterist church in Florida, in Arcadia, Florida, which is in the sunny southwest Florida. And so I lived there for 3 years. Very small congregation, but great people. They're a small congregation half the year because the snowbirds go down and fill out the congregation.
Right, sure. Yeah.
And so we had a great experience down there. I actually got to meet and know Brian McLaren while I was down there,
okay,
the author of A New Kind of Christian and a few other books. And we became friends, and I had a call from a buddy up in North Alabama, an hour from where I was raised, who said, hey, I'm stepping down from this church. I'm going to go do something else, but I can't think of anybody else that I'd want to fill my place other than you. Will you please come and take over? And I said, well, I don't really want to leave Southwest Florida. I'm doing pretty good down here. I kind of want to stay put. And he called me again and again and again. And so finally, after about 4 months, I said, sure, I'll just come and see what it's like. And so my wife and I, we took our son at this point, Caden. He was born right before COVID in January of 2020. We drove.
That's rough.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's pretty cool. Because you were home. Because I was home with him.
Yeah, because you're home. Yeah, that's true.
I didn't have to go do my sales job.
I think it's probably worse if your kid was just entering like first grade.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah. But since he was 2 months old at that point, I got to stay home from doing copier sales, and I got to be a stay-at-home dad for about a year while my wife did online teaching.
Oh, wow.
So it was...
Yeah, that was probably a jam, yeah.
Yeah, it was awesome. We went on walks every day, and I taught him how to walk and everything. It was great.
That's awesome.
Cool.
Who knows what I would have missed out on had he been in daycare.
You got maternity leave, paternity leave. Just by accident. But
government mandated paternity
leave. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we... Yeah, so that we moved back to North Alabama, got a house, started working with this church, the North Broad Street Church of Christ in Albertville, Alabama, and it has just been wonderful. They're not preterists, but they are grace-centered, and so they don't mind that that's my eschatological view. We just have fun discussions about it. I don't force it down their throats. They don't force their position down mine, and we just have good conversations when it comes up. But other than that, my primary job, I do most of the preaching, but my primary job is to work with the youth. And so we spend a lot of time hiking and kayaking and going to Six Flags and things like that. And
wow.
So we've been doing that going on 3 years. In 4 days, it'll be 3 years we've been there.
Wow, that's incredible.
Cool. Yeah.
So how about this? How about your family?
When we started having children, they came back a little bit more. Wanted to come see the kids, wanted to get to know the grandkids. So that's been good. We've started going back to Christmases and Thanksgivings and things like that now. But it still obviously is
a little awkward.
Pretty awkward.
Do they still think that you're going to hell, but there's hope for the children?
That is a suspicion of mine. Uh-huh. Yeah. And so I am being a little bit careful about that, especially as the kids get older and older,
Sure.
I wouldn't be comfortable with them spending the night at the grandparents' house and going to church with them the next day. It'd make me a little bit uneasy.
Because you think that the whole time they might be just like, like at the door shuts and they're like, all right, let's sit down.
Yeah, let me show you this.
The minute the door shuts, like, click.
Let's talk about your dad's love for the mandolin real quick.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they would actually do that, but they would feel,
I'm being hyperbolic.
But they would feel obligated to do that on some level because they really believe that their eternal soul is at stake. They would almost be kind of like Penn Jillette says about, he's an atheist magician, and he says that if Christians don't talk to him about God, he's almost offended because it's like, you think I'm going to burn in hell forever and you're not telling me how to get out of it? Like, that's really offensive to me,
Yeah, sure.
And so
you're not standing by your truth.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I know they have that obligation, but I am maybe naively hopeful that it won't
just
come to that.
Speaking for myself, I'm okay with you just thanking it. It's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't need to tell them about it.
Yeah. I think he was making more of a point about
consistency. Yeah.
And so who knows what the future holds, but we're doing really good right now, though.
So awesome. I want to kind of turn your testimony on its ear for just a second. I want to flip it. So let's go back to the very beginning.
Sure.
And let's talk about when you first discovered that all things were fulfilled.
Yeah.
And that you decided that this is what is necessary, is that I have to stand on this truth.
Sure.
And I need to tell it. And you're using it from a biblical teaching. This is a teaching that was already taught to you. It was indoctrinated in you, is that if you go back to Matthew 10, where it's going to divide the family, you already know that. Okay, so by looking back at that, can you see what Jesus was talking about to them at that time when they were living and what was really about to happen in their time?
Yeah.
And do you believe that what Jesus said to them is going to be in the fulfilled covenant era, that there's still going to be the division of family based on this? Because he was talking about things that were regarding to their physical lives.
Yeah.
Because they were either going to be destroyed or they were going to be taken out and they were going to escape it.
Right. And we'll think about it from a political perspective or a nationalistic perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about what happened to the people who stayed home from the wars, World War One, World War Two, Civil War, that were conscientious objectors or, didn't participate for some other reason. They were castigated.
They were.
Yeah. And so I think there was an element of that going on as well.
And you were castigated just by holding your truth.
Yeah, that's true.
So you can either go into war or not go into war, and you're still going to get castigated.
Well, that's true.
But in Jesus's time, if you didn't follow him out, you were going to be destroyed.
Yes.
That was a physical reality for them.
It was.
In a pretty gruesome way.
Yeah. So now you're in a church where people believe in grace and they're not going to castigate you because of your faith.
Right.
If everyone thought like that, this would be a much better place, wouldn't you say?
I would say so.
Yeah, I would agree. So I think a lot of the things that we were indoctrinated with, because I wasn't a cappella Church of Christ, but I was raised in a Southern Baptist church. So we were indoctrinated in our own, whatever it may be.
Sure.
But the idea here is that when you decide, I believe something different from the collective, that I have to stand on my truth. Is that accurate? Is that what the Bible actually teaches?
I guess it depends on to what degree, you know.
To what degree? Now we're giving it levels of degree. I'm not grilling you. I'm just saying, to what degree? And
let the negotiations begin.
My thought is that do you have to stand on the truth that's yours and make everyone else conform and convert to your way of thinking? Or is just standing on your truth good enough for you internally? Or do you have to take it external? Does it have to go external?
The question is crazy.
Aren't we supposed to be?
Is it crazy?
Yeah, it's not. The question is not crazy, but like the idea that there's an answer to that question is a little crazy.
There are ramifications for your actions, no matter what you believe.
Yeah, it's so just wild. It's so big.
It is very big, but that's my point. My point is that if I am determined that I'm going to change everybody else's belief to conform to what I think is reality or true, then I've already entered into this world where there's an opposition before we even get started.
That's true. Well, how I was going to answer that question was there's a passage in Galatians 5 that I absolutely love. And he's writing to this church that's divided over circumcision,
yes.
You know, which is just mind-blowing to us, right? Mm-hmm. And he says circumcision—
Well, we didn't get a choice in it.
That's true.
I mean, it was done when we were before we met a choice.
Yeah, speak for yourself. No, I'm not kidding. I'm kidding. Now everybody knows.
When Rick was very young, they gave him a little questionaire.
There's this figure within the evangelical church that everybody absolutely loves. They praise him all day long. His name's Rob Bell, and he had a sermon called "Bite Down Hard, My Man," and it was about and it was about the circumcision of Abraham. He said, and when he was given it, he said the alternative title was "You're going to do what to my what?"
Yeah. That's the first thing that I would have thought when Abraham came down and said, "Okay, all the males are going to get circumcised," to be like, "Who you been talking to, man?"
Yeah, right. Like what's up with God? Did you get this from God, or
like what?
That's an indoctrination moment right there, buddy.
Oh, geez.
I picture the rabbi from Robin Hood, Men in Tights, you know, little guillotine. he's writing to this church, and he says, the circumcision doesn't mean anything. Uncircumcision doesn't mean anything. The only thing that counts for anything is faith expressing itself in love.
Mm-hmm.
You can just imagine how churches would react if you said that to them about their particular thing.
That's right? Their thing. It's you just nailed it. Yeah. Very good.
Yeah.
It's the thing that you carry. When we say indoctrination, it's very negative. Yeah. You know, we're using it in a negative way. But for community, this is not a negative. This is a positive. We're holding together. We're a group. We believe this. And anyone that comes against this is going to divide our community. This is a huge problem for community, right? So what Paul is doing in his time is he's explaining, like, the community is going to survive because it's not about circumcision at all. It's about expressing your faith and love.
That's right.
And if that's the most important thing, and that was in a transitional period time, then that would be true even now. Expressing ourselves through loving others is the key. And that should be able to go across all lines. And it sounds like you're in a church that's doing that.
Yes, absolutely.
That's got to be a phenomenal thing.
It's wonderful. And we do things, we have a foster parents night out where there's an Episcopal church involved in that. And then there's a Baptist church that's involved in that.
Yeah.
How do you get people like that to work together?
Mm-hmm.
You know, just total opposite ends of the spectrum. And yet these people are coming together, not because of doctrine or anything, but because their faith is working itself in love by giving a place for foster kids to spend the night so their parents can have, you know, 3 or 4 hours to go out on a date.
Yeah.
You know?
Isn't that something? Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Man, I really enjoyed listening to your testimony. That's really got my brain thinking.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's good.
It's smoking in here.
Yeah, it is. So, but it is a lot cooler in here, Andy. Thank you.
Yes.
It's because of all the instruments. You know.
It's always cool in here, baby.
on the other side of the glass.
This episode is brought to you by Supply Chain Solutions.
Supply Chain Solutions is the third-party logistics company providing small to mid-sized businesses an outsourcing option focusing on warehouse management, customization of products, assembly and packaging of goods, and has the ability to meet business-to-business and business-to-consumer fulfillment needs. Supply Chain Solutions continually strive to be their customers' most highly valued partners for quality, delivery, responsiveness, and customer service. To learn more about Supply Chain Solutions, you can visit their website at www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com. That's www.supplychainsolutions3pl.com.
And now back to the show.
Well, thank you so much for being here. We don't have Billy Kimsey in here. He normally asks the final question on our testimony episodes. So I'll ask you, when you take your last breath here on earth, where do you go?
Oh, where I've always been, in the presence of the divine.
Hmm.
God in me, me in God, Christ in me, Christ in God.
Yeah. I keep talking about in Christ. That is such a huge statement, in him.
Yep.
That's good. Well, Daniel, thanks for being here, man.
Thank you.
It's been great.
I'm so glad that you came, and I'm looking forward to this
study. I hate that you got to drive all the way home here in a minute.
Yeah.
Oh, I know.
he's got a little while before we have to go.
5 hours.
Is that a 5-hour drive?
That's a great time to listen to some Burrows of Berea.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and buy things from our sponsors.
Yeah, exactly.
Just skip this episode and this episode and this episode.
So, guys, if you'll listen in over the next couple of weeks, we're going to be releasing a series that Daniel's going to do with us called The Eschatology of First John. So check that out. But again, Daniel, thanks for coming on and sharing your testimony, man. And I hope that we'll build a relationship here and just keep talking.
I wish you would have brought your mandolin.
Me too.
You don't have one here, Andy?
No, I don't own a mandolin.
He's got a ukulele. It's close enough.
I would love to have a mandolin.
Ukulele, isn't that like the...
It's like the mandolin of banjos. Yeah.
It is.
I have no idea what that means.
Anyway. Well, we are in the mountains.
Yeah.
Banjos are prevalent.
Big Daddy, thanks for being here.
Yeah.
Andy, appreciate you, man. All right, guys. We will talk to you again next time on the Burrows of Berea. Peace out.
Later.
Hey guys, this is Rick from the Burrows of Berea. A lot of people have been asking us, hey, what is this Patreon thing? Our old Patreon ad didn't work very well. So here you go, guys. Go to www.patreon, that is patreon.com. Let me do that again. patreon.com/ the Burrows of Berea. If you go to the Patreon page, you will find that we have different levels that you can give at. We have a $3 level, a $5 level. We've got a $10 level and a $20 level. I thought about putting a $1,000 level there, but you never know how that's going to work out, right, Andy? That's right. So go to www.patreon.com/ the Burrows of Berea and give us all of your money.
Even a little bit will be fine.
Yeah. And that 5,000 wouldn't hurt my
either. No, it would hurt nobody.
Thanks, guys. So as I was coming in, Daniel, I saw your license plate. Does it have any meaning or is it just a number that was randomly given to you?
The number 50?
No, it says 50ABUBY.
No, it's just random. Yeah.
Just random?
Yep.
Because I was like, I wonder if that has a meaning because it'd be like 50 a booby. So it's like the police are bad. Is that like a subtle?
Oh, yeah.
It's 50.
Oh, the 50.
BUBY.
You're not a defund the police, are you?
Are you
No. The 50 is our county code for Marshall County. So in Alabama, they have a rating system, you know, for all the number of counties. And so when I was growing up, the county code was 13 for Cherokee County, 11 for Calhoun County, and then 50 is Marshall County.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then ABUBY was just random. But we call my brother Bubby. So it's really easy to remember because it's 50 a Bubby.
Sweet.
So see, it does have it does mean something to you.
Huh. Just accidentally.
I was like, 50 a booby. Uh-huh.
50 a booby. 50 boobies.
Yeah. I'm almost 50 and I have boobies. That's the sad fact.
There it is.
You got to turn the car upside down like you did the calculator to see it.
That's why nobody gets it.
Right. Yeah. If I ever wreck, I'll be in trouble.
Yeah. That's good.